ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves. We stood tall and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. It's great to have your company. We live in an increasingly polarised world. So when it comes to the vexed issues of our time, is there still a place for sitting on the fence? The award-winning Australian author and writer for theatre and screen, Christos Tsolkas. Yes, you know him for his books The Slap, The In-Between, Barracuda, Damascus. He has always wrestled with gnarly ethical terrain in his books. And he writes, we are urged at all times and for every occasion to take a position. Yet is there a utility, both practical and ethical, in taking a breath, a pause, and refusing to land definitively on a stance? Well, today, Christos Tsolkas on fence sitting and its place in the modern world. And in thinking about this idea of fence sitting, Christos also says this. The fence can be a border, and of course a border can sequester and isolate. A fence, however, can also be a place of communion, a place of speaking to one another across fixed notions of being and boundary. If sitting on the fence is deeply suspect and deeply resented, what of the notion of speaking across the fence? It's that question Christos Tsolkas is about to explore in his 2025 Ray Matthew Lecture at the National Library of Australia on Ngunnawal and Ngambri Country.
What a generous and lovely introduction. Thank you so much. I want to begin by acknowledging the Ngunnawal and the Ngambri people in that paying of respect, to say that there may be some issues that are complex or difficult that I'm going to talk about tonight about being a writer at this current moment. What is absolutely thrilling is that in the 30 plus years that I've been doing this, that the writing of First Nations people in this country is flowering to such a magnificent extent that it is in our literature, in our film, on our theatre stages, in our art galleries. It's so different to the world I entered as a young writer in the mid-1990s, and I am really proud and humbled to be part of a storytelling tradition that goes back so many millennia. Public libraries, I often say, they're one of the few spaces that have evaded economic rationalists, that they are still spaces of public utility. I loved reading. My parents did their best to get me books, but they didn't have the privilege of education. They showed me the library, and it was in the library that I first read the books that made me think, maybe one day I can do this. Can I write? And that space of the library is so very, very important culturally, and I am very honoured to be part of this. And I want to thank you. Preparing a lecture is a daunting process and a great responsibility. I hope that what I have to say tonight is of interest and that it sparks a conversation and a debate. I think the debate is so very important. A conversation of good faith, which is not to say that we have to agree with each other, but that we trust each other, that there are important things to do with culture that we need to discuss honestly, faithfully. I'm also taking very seriously the responsibility of Ray Matthew, who bequeathed this lecture to the Australian public. I've been thinking very much about this, how what I want to say needs to be centred on the work that Matthew did and the work that I do, that is, the work, the labour of writing. Whether as a writer of fiction or as a playwright, I want this lecture to be about writing, to honour something called fiction. So over the last few weeks and months, really, I've been thinking a lot about fiction, about why I love it and why I want to defend it tonight. If I'm acutely aware of the responsibility attendant to this lecture, I'm also equally aware of the privilege. For me, as with the best writing, this is an opportunity to think out loud. I don't wish to pretend that my observations and thoughts are completely formed, that they are not assailable by doubts and questions. Again, this is the grace of being able to be involved in a discussion and debate with you all. It is precisely because of the importance of this notion of thinking out loud presented by the lecture that I feel excited and I feel daunted. As I hope to make clear in this talk, I think doubt one of the most important strategies that a writer can use, both in a more formal essay form, such as this lecture, as well as in the work we write as fiction. So I went around and around in my head for weeks. What form would this lecture take? I came up with the idea of fence sitting precisely because it embodied something about the necessity of doubt that I think is being lost in our current intellectual debates. This is an age of certainty, enabled by partisan cultural spaces that prioritise the declamatory over the questioning, the either-or over the maybe, possibly. In the classroom, at writers' festivals, in criticism and in journalism, doubt is viewed with suspicion that it is always prevarication, or worst, as compliance. In choosing as my theme fence sitting, I wanted to advocate for a position of doubt as thoughtfulness, as attention. And I wanted to be playful. I started with a draft that took a moment from my childhood when I was a very young boy in inner city Melbourne, such a long time ago that the inner city was both working class and migrant. I was going to tell you the story of the back fence of our house, made of old wood palings that seemed so enormous to me as a little child. I was envious of older cousins who managed to scale the fence, whose feet magically found the exact right spot on the horizontal plank, and with one powerful exertion, they would grab the top of the fence, hoist themselves up, and drop to the other side. And they would disappear. How I used to envy them. The fence was a marker between infancy and something elusive, both tantalising and frightening, something called growing up. I was going to tell you of that magical day that my arms and legs suddenly found strength, and though I slipped a few times, though I got a splinter in the pad of one of my fingers, I finally had climbed that fence. And tell you of the excitement I had felt sitting on the boundary between home and the world beyond. I remember looking down, and there was terror at how immense, how frightening the drop to the alley below seemed. My cousins were calling out, "Jump, Christo, jump!" And I wanted to tell you of something magical I saw atop of the old fence in Richmond. Across from our house, on the other side of the alley, there were a block of flats. I knew the alley and I knew those flats. We played footy in the alley as kids, both Aussie footy and real footy, as my parents called soccer. And we played cricket there, which neither of my parents understood. I'd even hidden on the concrete stairwell to the flats during a game of hide and seek. Yet on top of that fence, I suddenly found that I could look across to the windows on the other side, into a bedroom and into a small galley kitchen. There were colourful ceramic cats piled on the sill. Years later, watching Hitchcock's masterpiece Rear Window on the TV, I found myself jolted upright, the memory of my first climb flooding back. I hadn't seen a murder. I hadn't even seen a human being in that flats. Yet sitting there atop of the fence, I had an inkling that there were stories to be told. I wondered who lay on that single bed. Who was it that loved cats so much? My cousins were still calling for me to jump. I closed my eyes, gripped the fence, and I jumped. So that moment was going to be the beginning of the talk. Yet something happened as I started taking notes, sifting through memories, starting to write these paragraphs. I received a flurry of texts from someone who used to be a friend for over 30 years. He had read the subject of my lecture tonight and he was furious with me. "So that's what you've become, Cholkas," he began. "A fucking sellout, too scared to take sides." The message finished in triumphant indignation. Well, we all now know the coward you have become. The words now and coward were capitalized, and the sentence completed with a flourish of exclamation marks, those ubiquitous markers of outrage and bile for keyboard warriors. I'm not a fool. I understand very well the provocation in the subject of this talk. There is carnage in Gaza, and alongside it there is an upswelling of anti-Semitism that has shocked me in its ferocity, its poisonous tenacity. 2 weeks ago there were fascists marching in my city. Fascists who violently attacked a camp set up to proclaim the historic sovereignty of Aboriginal peoples on this land. The world is burning. Authoritarians are in power the world over. And I want to talk about sitting on the fence. My friend's venom was a howl. How dare you? I'd wanted to tell you the story of my childhood, to find a way to express something of all of this that was not bound in rage. I'm so sick of rage, at its violence, at its pitiless rancor, yet the furious text had the desired effects. I too became enraged. I too wanted to hate. Instead, I took a step back. I had to find a way to answer these charges of complicity without surrendering to rage. I ripped up what I had written and I started again. I need to explain to you all why I feel this suspicion of rage, of why I think it might be compromising our writing, our culture, our journalism, and our shared humanity. So I began again.
On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas today, acclaimed author and playwright Christos Tsolkas on fence-sitting in a time of conflict and polarisation. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and Christos is delivering the 2025 Ray Matthew Lecture at the National Library of Australia in Canberra.
It is 2019, and my partner Wayne and I are in Budapest. The last time I had been in that city was 1990, that year of immense, I think we can say it, right? World-shattering change that began with the Velvet Revolutions that tore apart the communist world that dominated Eastern Europe. Back then, I'd only managed one night in the city. Though the communist regimes had tumbled, the city was still caught in the strangeness, the excitement and trepidation of revolution. My memory of it is that it was full of grey. When I attempted to find a hotel room, I was shunted from building to building until finally it was explained to me that the only possible accommodation was at the outskirts of the city. I ended up in an old army barrack, sharing a bunk bed with a young Swedish tourist who had contracted food poisoning. The poor guy was constantly retching, heading to the toilet, which stank and had overfilled with vomit, piss and shit. After a sleepless night, I caught the first bus back to the central station and bought myself a ticket that I hoped would get me to Bratislava. In 2019, almost 30 years later, that astonishing city of two parts, the Buda and the Pest, on either side of the Danube, seemed unrecognisable. The beauty was astonishing. Friends had recommended we visit the Museum of Communism, and Wayne and I dutifully negotiated the metro and bus that took us out to the city's outskirts. As we left the dazzling city behind and the bus speeded on a highway that dissected open fields, I turned to Wayne. Mate, I think I've been here before. But it was impossible to tell if this indeed had been the site of my stay so long ago. History, as is its wont, had eradicated that certainty of memory. The Museum of Communism was a disappointment. There were a few statues of Lenin covered in bird shit, signage that was falling apart, the English words indecipherable from the erosion over years of rain, sleet and snow. It was a strange experience walking through that park. In the early 1990s, the communist presence still had real power, even as it had collapsed. Back then, the statues of Lenin and Marx seemed to contain an element of charisma. In the West, we were assured that the revolutions upturning the Soviet states had vanquished communism for good. Yet in 1990, that promise or that threat was still unsettled. In Theo Angelopoulos' 1999 film, Ulysses Gaze, A barge takes an immense statue of Lenin down the Danube. The statue once stood tall, proudly, as a beacon to the future. It has been toppled and is being taken to the graveyard where monuments go to die. Yet something remarkable happens in the film as the barge slowly carries its load down the ancient river. On the riverbanks, the peasants watching suddenly fall to their knees and they start praying. That film always begins another memory for me, or another recollection. A few years later, in the mid-90s, when I'm in North London with a friend and we visit Karl Marx's grave at Highgate Cemetery. We were old comrades, but then the word required quotation marks around it. In the 1980s, we had been contributors to a Marxist magazine. We had written about the inevitable collapse of capitalism. We took photos posing against Marx's grave, having a bit of a laugh. There's still a photo of me with my arm wrapped around Marx's bust. Suddenly, we were aware of a family looking at us sternly. They were clearly Eastern European, their features unmistakably Slavic, the women's hairs covered in scarves that I recognised as Balkan. My first thought was that they had experienced the violence and dislocation of communism and were sternly disapproving of these two men making a joke of their history. My friend and I sheepishly jumped off the grave. Then we watched as the family placed bouquets of flowers on Karl Marx's tomb, as the woman kneeled before it and crossed herself in the Orthodox Christian manner. It was a truly shocking image, the incongruity of Christian peasant faith and prayer being directed towards Marx, the Jewish intellectual that alongside Charles Darwin laid the foundations of the atheism and secularism that was to dominate the ensuing century. That moment of shock has never left me. It became foundational as an inspiration to a novel I wrote called Dead Europe. It remains unshakable still, for here I am, still talking about it. But in the Museum of Communism, the statues and monuments had lost all their power. They seemed as irrelevant, as laughable as the statues to British explorers that dot my city in Melbourne. They too no longer speak to us. There was a small auditorium at the park, adjacent to the entrance. When we first arrived, it had been closed, unattended. We noticed a woman unlocking the doors. We paid our forints and entered. It was a cinema, tiny, and we were the only people there. A card flashed on the screen, in Hungarian and in English. It stated that we were about to see a collection of training films from the AVH, the Secret State Police, the Hungarian equivalent to the KGB. They were black and white, from the 60s and 70s, untranslated, uncurated. One short began, another started. No attempt at continuity or structure. We watched as suited men and women showed how to plant bugs into telephones, how to keep vigilant distance from figures they were following. One piece of footage seemed to be indicating how to entrap gay men and then blackmail them into spying on their friends and family. The tiny cinema, the awful repetition of numbing state surveillance, it started making us both feel dirty. It was the banality of something called terror. No scenes of violence, of torture, just the constant valorisation of spying, of not allowing humans one space free of constant observation. After a while, we left, feeling dirty. On the bus back into the city, we were silent. It was as if someone had caught us in a porno cinema. Later that night, having dinner, reflecting back on the visit, I started to get emotional. Wayne listened to me as I tried to make sense of the anger I was feeling, an anger that was in part directed at my fellow writers. My experiences of travelling through Eastern Europe, first as a very young man in 1990 and then again through the 90s, have been some of the most sobering of my life. For as a writer, I am part of a progressive left-wing milieu which identifies itself as being on the side of the angels. And I am immensely drawn to the radical works of fiction and art that have denounced the terrors of colonialism, of misogyny, of racism, of homophobia. Yet I had once advocated for a system of belief that enacted its own terror and its own dehumanisation. I should have known that that terror was embedded in the foundational revolutionary violence of the French Revolution, has re-emerged in subsequent revolutions, and blighted attempts at transformation across Eastern Europe, Asia, Africa, the Americas, the Middle East. "We have to be responsible to that history," I said to Wayne. He smiled sadly at me, and he said, "That night, on the Buddha side of the city, looking down at the placid waters of the Danube, filled with tourist cruise boats, I remember him saying, 'You wear that responsibility heavily, Chris.' I do. I think we sure all should. And in part, that explains my investment in doubt. I believe that if we are to advocate a politics and an aesthetic that valorises the left-wing, the progressive, justice, we are bound to take seriously the inhumanity embedded in so many attempts at transformation. And I was wrong. And I might be wrong again. That doesn't mean I don't have political faith. But as with religious faith, to not question, to not listen to oppositional perspectives, to not read from writers and thinkers who may not necessarily share our worldview, is to allow our beliefs and practices to become atrophied. Another word for that is fundamentalist. All fundamentalists, whether religious or political or aesthetic, deny the humanity of others." This was the great insight of Hannah Arendt in her monumental work, The Origins of Totalitarianism. The National Socialists divided the world in terms of race. The Bolsheviks divided the world in terms of class. Enormous human suffering was justified by such divisions. And so I want to be very precise here. It's important for you in order to understand why I was feeling so despairing that night in Budapest, of what I was experiencing that evening after the excursion to the Museum of Communism. If we as writers wish to hold conservatives and the right wing responsible for the inanity of the climate wars, for the denial of the murderous legacy of colonisation in our country, Australia, and of colonisation everywhere, if we want to hold right-wing ideologies responsible for the heinous legacies of racism and misogyny and rampant capital exploitation, then we also have to hold that mirror to ourselves. The terror of the Gulag, of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, the rise of a vitriolic cancel culture in our artistic and academic institutions. We have to face that mirror and refute the comfort that comes from thinking we are the elect and that those who don't think the same way as we do are wrong, that we are always right. I repeat it. I have been wrong and I will be wrong again. Two of the most remarkable novels I've read over the last 5 years since returning from Eastern Europe are written by writers who grew up in East Germany. One is The Tower by Uwe Tellkamp, written in 2008. The other is Keros, the Greek word meaning time, a more recent novel written by Jenny Erpenbach. They are both set in the 1980s, the last decade of the German Democratic Republic. The Tower was recommended to me by a friend who had been born in the GDR and was a young adult when Germany was reunified. Tellkamp's novel is difficult, formally and thematically. It is multi-voice, multi-generational story that uses repetition and an almost mind-numbing close description of details. The look of a street, of shadows, the veneer of a desk. He does so to suggest the paranoia and stifling of liberty within the East German state. I don't think I've ever read a novel of such claustrophobic intensity. Reading it, I didn't feel dirty as I had been in that squalid little theatrette in the Museum of Communism in Budapest. But I did feel ashamed. What kept me going as a reader, what deflected from the risk of tedium inherent in Tellkamp's deliberate and formally abstract prose, was a submerged yet always attendant anger. I didn't feel dirty, but I felt ashamed. The left-wing figures in The Tower are deluded at best. Often they are venal, righteously framed politics to settle scores with enemies and with potential rivals. It is as if reading the novel, a voice was coldly whispering in my ear. Yes, not only were you wrong, you were willfully, ignorantly wrong. Erpenbeck's novel has greater mercy. If in the end the inhumanity and corruption of the GDR are exposed, made irrefutable to both the main character and to us as readers, there is also a remarkable detailing of the quotidian realities of living in the communist state. Now that the GDR has disappeared, these ordinary everyday realities have a patina of wonder to them, as if we have stepped back into some imagined wonderland. Something as ordinary as taking a train, navigating a divided city, has some of that strangeness of Alice Through the Looking Glass. Queiroz is a more disciplined novel than The Tower. Erpenbeck's greatest risk is to frame the story of the dying days of the state around a sadomasochistic affair that takes place between the narrator and an older man. I was initially resistant to that choice, dubious as to whether it was too obvious, almost a cliche of the relationship between the state and the individual under totalitarianism. What convinced me, apart from the precise beauty of the writing, is that Erpenbeck complicates the story, refuses the too easy reduction of human behaviour and human belief into a story of victim and oppressor, the easy moralism of good versus evil. It would be a monstrous misreading of Queiroz to get to the end and not be dismayed, even despairing at the blindness of the protagonist to the malevolence embodied in the Stasi state. Queiroz indicates that even good people can be wrong, mistaken, allow malevolence to flourish. I didn't feel dirty reading the novel, nor did I feel ashamed. I felt deeply sorrowful. For me, the experience of reading The Tower and Queiroz in quick succession embodies something of the experience of fence-sitting, that provocative, rage-inducing concept that brings to mind wishy-washy politics and the washing of hands from any engagement in the reality of suffering and injustice. Do I look down and submit to the unquestionably legitimate negation of all progressive politics embodied in The Tower's condemnation of the miserable reach of socialist and progressive ideologies? Telkamp's rage is almost sacred at the annihilation of liberty and freedoms he thinks are inherent in such beliefs. Or do I look across to a less caustic, less damning version of misplaced faith that Jenny Erpenbeck writes about in Queiroz? Yet, to different effects, both novels affirm something essential about living under authoritarian regimes, that yes, terror is being beaten up in a prison cell, that it is being clubbed by police at a demonstration, but it is also being made to scrutinise every statement, every throwaway line of a colleague of work, of a family member at a birthday. All of this is terror. It is automatically assuming that any work you read, play you see, film you watch, song you hear must be inspected for possible subversion. It is the fear that any dissent from orthodoxy is inherently suspicious. There are enough censors in a world, I don't think we writers need to be censors. I fear this policing of dissent is now increasingly prevalent in Australian arts and letters. Again, I want to be clear, I'm not advocating against a passionate faith in something, be that passion for a truly ecological, sustainable future, a reconciled post-colonial Australia, an end to the catastrophic loss of life in Palestine, or at the outrage felt by so many of us at the resurgence of atavistic anti-Semitism across the left and right. Yet that question, could I be wrong, is one I think is crucial for we writers to keep at the forefront of our conscience when we write. So I am advocating fence sitting as a pause, a necessary stillness required to think through the implications of where we land when we jump off that fence. That advocating of a pause is, I believe, even more necessary in a media age where digital technology and AI are escalating the proliferation of soundbites and sloganeering that attempt to reduce the complexity of political phenomena to good versus evil. And this is why I advocate for fiction, for playwriting, for any artistic endeavour. Unlike a tweet, a TikTok video, a slogan on a t-shirt, the composing of writing requires time, innumerable moments of pause and reflection. It demands thoughtfulness, and thoughtfulness opens up the space for questions and for doubt. I trusted reading Erpenbeck and I trusted reading Telkamp, for if their works are so very different and their conclusions are so very dissimilar, it is evident that they took the question of responding to history and to terror and to regret seriously. That one of them is progressive politically and one is a conservative doesn't matter. The work matters. The writing matters. The labours of reading them seriously, diligently, of stopping, reflecting on the language and what the language expresses, that matters. That is the pause of sitting on the fence.
The role of the writer in taking pause, rather than a position perhaps. The function of fence-sitting in a time of dissent, disintegration, dislocation. Christos Tsolkas, multi-award-winning author of The Slap, The In-Between, Barracuda, Damascus. He is delivering the 2025 Ray Matthew Lecture at the National Library of Australia in Canberra. And now he draws on a story of suffering from his own family history.
I've talked about this and it's important that I will talk about it again because there's something in my own family history that is crucial to understanding why I'm drawn to the notion of fence-sitting for this lecture. The fence, of course, is a demarcation of boundary and so of exclusion. At its ugliest, at its most vile, we see it in the notion of an Australian continent fenced off from the immigrant intruder. That horrible cartoon of fuck off, we're full. Yet the fence is also a boundary, and for many of us, we were born into and we navigate boundaries. I think most of the most important and wondrous writing coming from our nation at the moment is from people who are acutely aware of boundary, of the margin. As a child of Greek immigrants and of factory workers, I was conscious from so early of the demarcations of language, of class and ethnicity. I had to learn to speak between two languages. What I now see is a terrific opportunity for me as a writer. And in that sense, there is nothing very unique about my story. So many of us here, thankfully, are the children and grandchildren of immigrants. But what was special about my family circumstances, and something I didn't appreciate till I was much older, was that my mother and father, both of the peasant class, were from families that were on either side of the civil war in Greece. My mother's family were communists and socialists, my father's anti-communist. I grew up in a household where politics and arguments were happening around the table all the time. Both my parents loved entertaining. My mother was and is a great cook, which I have to say, I'm a Greek boy. And so the house, especially on the weekend, would be filled with music, laughter and argument. My mother was and is much more forthright than my father was. And I was galvanised by the stories of the miseries and ugliness of the Civil War. That was the connecting thread between my parents. That was what made them able to argue without spite, without hatred. They both knew that monstrous acts were committed by both sides in the war. Nevertheless, I was drawn to my mother's side of politics. One of my earliest memories is of her crying when told that her brother had disappeared in Athens. I may have been 5, I may have been 6. We didn't have a phone in the house. There was an older Australian neighbour a few doors down and she would often be awoken in the middle of the night by calls from Greece, Italy, Yugoslavia. She'd put on a nightie and come knocking on the door. Quick, quick, George, quick, quick, Georgia, I think it's your sister. I think it's Greece. My mother still calls that woman a saint. She said, as I've met a saint, that woman was a saint to us. It was one such night when we were all awoken by a knock. My parents went to answer. I remember hearing my mother's sobs as they were walking back up the street. My uncle, an activist and unionist in Athens, had disappeared, and it was feared that he had been taken by the military police attached to the then military dictatorship. In those early years, we all slept in the same room, my parents on their big bed, my brother and I wrapped arm in arm in a single bed. I pretended to be asleep, but I was listening. I heard my mother express her fears, her terror, that her brother would be tortured, that he would be killed. He wasn't killed, he was tortured. Years later, when I was a young adult, this same uncle took me to the gates of the military prison where he had been held. He explained how he'd been tied up, beaten on the soles of his feet so brutally that years later he still walked with a limp. But he considered himself lucky that he hadn't been murdered. That was terror. And those stories were integral to making me left wing. My father, however, rarely discussed his childhood. It was only at his death, when one of his cousins who lived in Sydney came to stay with us over the funeral and wake period, that I discovered that he had left the village as a 13-year-old and worked as a bellhop in a hotel in Patra for a couple of years. Never heard that. He was one of 12 children, born in poverty, a shepherd as a child, a worker from early teens. His story seems so as wondrous as Alice through that looking glass. To his children, to me, my brother, and to his grandchildren. It was only as an adult in Greece that I discovered the reason why his peasant family were right-wingers. His older brother, who is the man I am named after, had the misfortune to be drafted into the army during the Civil War for the communist guerrillas that made him automatically the enemy. He was beheaded on a mountain close to the village where he had been born. It was my father who was charged by the family to go and collect the body. My father was 17. The story gutted me, it still does. I had to rethink all of my accepted notions of right and wrong, of politics. It was the same humbling emotions I felt travelling through an Eastern Europe just emerging from the blight of Soviet rule. When I returned to Australia and expressed to my father my sorrow at what he had experienced, he became furious at his siblings that they had told me of this. "This is why I migrated here," Christo, he said. "So you and your brother need not know any of this." So this is a man who was able to love a woman who didn't share his politics. This was a man who was able to hold both things in his hands. That the terror committed by one side, creates an equal heartbreak, an equal suffering, an equal pain to the terror inflicted by the other side. This is the great gift that both my parents bestowed on me. Can you understand then why I might at times lack sympathy for the outraged calling outs and blacklistings and self-righteous condemnations of the New Age digital warriors? That there is another side, another perspective, a duty to compassion that comes from borders and from margins. Again, the duty of a pause. Again, the requirement we have as writers to try at least to comprehend the humanity of the other. We might fail, but at least try to comprehend. And more so, I think the duty we have is not to compare suffering to a sports game, with each terror, each death, each annihilation a goal on the scoreboard. And then there was something that changed for me as a reader when I returned from that long year away in Greece, in Eastern Europe, in 1990. I'd started to shed a notion of good and evil, one I had imbued from religion, and which, on abandoning God, I still attached to my engagement with politics. That puritanical notion of there being the elect, those who are right, and then there are the damned, those who are mistaken, it started to seem increasingly dangerous to me. I always laugh with Wayne that in this mania for decolonising everything, the one thing I would love to decolonise is the Puritan Calvinist underpinning to so much political language. I would love to decolonise that. I found that I had started to read differently. I think of Solzhenitsyn, who I used to say I hated. Proudly. I hated before I even read him. I remember as a teenager being forced at school to read A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich through gritted teeth. I didn't want to like it. I'd heard he was anti-communist and I was going to make damn sure I didn't like it. I pronounced it boring to my teacher. After I returned from Eastern Europe, I picked it up again. I was moved by the simplicity of how the writer explained physical and moral suffering. I was broken by how even in the most malevolent of places, there was still an aspiration of hope. I had learnt something. I wasn't merely reading to have myself and my world and my views reaffirmed. Is this fence sitting, or is it something else? Is it patience? I think it is being able to look over the fence and acknowledge the neighbour. I will never share Solzhenitsyn's spiritual certainty, and I will always be suspicious of the idolisation of nationhood that is there in so much of his work. Yet I can now, metaphorically, shake his hand. Actually, more appropriate is to say his bow. And I can acknowledge the wisdom of his writing and his experience and his astonishing ability to communicate a legacy of suffering. You don't have to sit on the fence, but I do think we need to read across the fence. I'm an old man. A younger friend said to me the other day, "Nah, I'm not going to bother with reading white, cis, straight male writers anymore." I think she put in the adjective straight to mollify me. I laughed and I cheekily recommended her Andrew O'Hagan and David Peace, two straight male, cis, white writers that I love. I wasn't outraged. Hers is not a position I would take, as I hope I have explained in what I have said above. Foreclosing the joy or beauty or wisdom, the insight or pleasure we receive as readers from writers who are not like ourselves is, I think, a mistake. Yet as someone who has been writing for a long time in this culture, I'm also excited at the voices from the margins, from the other side of fences, that are now available to us as readers. And I'm not unaware of a privilege I have, a privilege not bounded by categories of identity, but one of place and time, that I was able to start writing before the dominance of social media, before the scrutiny, surveillance, and self-righteous judgment afforded by such technology. It's a harsher time for writers to make a living, to get their books out there, to speak out, to not always agree. So I'm old, I'm turning 60 next month, and I'm aware that there are experiences and artwork and media work out there that has passed me by. A few months ago, I got sick with pneumonia and ended up in a hospital for 3 days. My main takeaway from that experience was how fortunate I am to live in a country where we have a national health system. Yes, the medical staff were overworked, harried, but they were also generous. They were disciplined and kind. However, by the third day of my stay, I was climbing the walls. And when a nurse came into the ward and asked, "Is it okay if we make you a test case for visiting medical students?" I agreed immediately. I ended up being a test patient for 4 groups of medical students that day. One lovely young man asked me, "Christos, how are you feeling?" I explained that I was feeling much better. The fever had gone and that I was grateful for the medical care I was receiving. And then I added, "It has made me think about my mortality, that I'm getting old, that my body can't do as much as it once did." I can't forget the look of shock on the young man's face. "No, no," it was like that, he repeated, "you're not old." It was as if that word, old, was an insult. I tried to explain that it was inevitable, aging, and that it didn't need to be terrifying. I also added that when I was a young boy, and this is really true, walking the streets of my neighbourhood in Melbourne, I used to look at the old yayas and papus on their porches, drinking their coffee, invariably smoking their cigarettes as they looked out onto the world, and I used to think it would be nice to do that one day. Just sit, watch the world go by. But I don't know if I convinced the medical student. Years ago, reading The Rest Is Noise, listening to the 20th Century, that remarkable book about 20th century classical music by Alex Ross, I was struck by a comment from the Finnish composer Sibelius. He knew that the romantic music he was composing mid-20th century was distinctly out of fashion, that he was being dismissed by the avant-garde. He had come to terms with this estrangement. All that he desired was a space to make his own, where he could write the music he wanted to write and needed to write, no longer caught up in the vagaries of fashion. He stepped away. It's not an insult to be asked to step away. It's an insult to demand that we stop writing, that anyone stop writing. I am aware, maybe a bit like the medical student, that some of the younger members of this audience listening to me tonight might be asking, what has this wandering through the 20th century got to do with me, with my world now, with what is happening in the world now? Very good questions. My reply would be that history is necessary. Truth-telling is necessary. That also means that progressives and left-wingers who dominate the arts and cultural industries also need to know our own history. Of the possibilities that we've created, but also the terrors we've created and the mistakes we've made. Pausing, doubting, questioning. These are necessary. And youth becomes age. I was really moved about 20 years ago. The Film Comment, the great film magazine, had done a special on May 68, that enormously challenging time, particularly in France, but worldwide. And they were asking contemporary filmmakers to respond to May 68. And Olivier Assayas, who I think is a remarkable director, I love his films. He was talking about a film called Far From Vietnam, a documentary, a compendium of short films made by some of the best directors of that time who were also responding immediately to May 68. And Assayas wrote that he was shocked that filmmakers he loved, he respected, like Chris Marker, the great documentary filmmaker, like Michelangelo Antonioni, one of the greatest artists who ever worked in film, could go to China in the Cultural Revolution and not see the violence and terror there. I know you will never know how history is going to look back on us. Years ago, when I was a bolshy, vainglorious young writer, I was at a writer's festival and I met David Malouf. I had loved his writing from high school, but in that arrogance of youth, I remember being dismissive of him for not being more vocal, politically, as a writer from a migrant background, as a gay man. I wanted to out him to be out. I'm ashamed of that supercilious dismissal now, of how ignorant I was, and how dismissive I was of its terror, the terror of something called the closet. And of how Malouf has worked so hard, so beautifully, so uncompromisingly in telling us about the world in every piece of fiction he has ever written. When later I read his novel Ransom, I just knew I had read something great of all time, and I was shattered. In that novel, he tells one small moment from the Iliad, when Priam approaches a still enraged Achilles, who has just killed Priam's son, Hector. Achilles has also desecrated Hector's body and refuses to give it over to Priam for the proper funeral rites. Achilles is maddened by the death of his beloved at Hector's hand. Ransom is a work that I have kept returning to since my father died 13 years ago. It is the work that reminds me of my parents' great gift to me, that of compassion, of understanding the other side, of not reveling in rage. I think compassion is greater, more important than rage. But maybe that's an old man speaking. The young child that was so elated when he finally scaled the backyard fence hasn't forgotten the surprise and wonder of sitting on that fence, of looking across to that alley, seeing the world anew. But eventually he did drop to the other side. He went off exploring. He came back. He kept exploring. One of the most important books I've read over the last few years is called Faces of Moderation, The Art of Balance in an Age of Extremes. It is a series of essays about intellectuals in the 20th century who tried to find middle paths between the extremes of violence of both the left and the right. The author is Aurelien Cratou, an academic now living in the USA, but who was born and raised in Soviet-era Romania. Anyone with any knowledge of history knows that of all the communist regimes, the Romanian might have been the most awful. There, human dignity ceased to be of any value. Trying to steer a path through and against partisanship isn't a cop-out for Kreitu. It's an ethical necessity. And it's been a tonic to read this book, to be introduced to thinkers I should have read a long time ago, thinkers who believe that there was a way of being just in this world without succumbing to the terrors, the annihilation demanded by regimes across the left and the right. One of the thinkers he examines is Norberto Bobbio, an Italian humanist writer who tried to navigate between the violence of resurgent fascism and the appalling left nihilism exemplified by the terrorist Red Brigade. Bobbio wrote, "Moderation is a word I am not ashamed of using, as long as it is interpreted positively as the opposite of extremism and not negatively as the opposite of radicalism." I'm not sure that such a sentiment would appease my friend who was so withering about the subject of my talk. Yet that ability to understand that one can still work in radical ways, think in radical ways, write in radical ways, act and love and think in radical ways that don't submit to extremism, to the nullification of the other, is now a guide for me. I'm not proposing we always sit on the fence. However, I am suggesting that as writers, playwrights, intellectuals, we are required to doubt and we are required to question. And we need that space. I'm not sure our cultural institutions, our writers' festivals, are doing all they can to create such spaces at the moment. Late in Journey Erpenbeck's Geros, her protagonist observes a group of people debating politics. She writes of the argument, "In the party group of the Goethe Society, there is a debate about evolution versus revolution. Change the system from inside or outside? Do the young have to be taught patience or the old reminded of their former impatience?" Can I leave you with that question? Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
Christos Tsolkas, author of The Slap, The In-Between, Barracuda, Damascus, amongst other acclaimed novels and plays, films and TV adaptations. He was delivering the 2025 Ray Matthew Lecture at the National Library of Australia in Canberra. Big thanks to the library team and to ABC sound engineer Christian Huff Johnson for that recording. And you'll have thoughts on the case that Christos makes, I have no doubt. The case for fence-sitting, for doubt, for ambiguity in creative works, and I'd love to hear them. Our email address is bigideas@abc.net.au. Big Ideas brings you big thinkers at live events across Australia and the world with their big ideas. My name is Natasha Mitchell, and you can find and follow Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app wherever you get your podcasts. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.